I have a question for you.
Oh,
if you
we
recall
go.
Back, oh no, I know. You remember the very first video we recorded together? I introduced the concepts of the computer and the boxes and everything. Even now, when I sit down and try and solve computer problems, especially performance and sort of very sort of techie things, I still kind of mentally picture the things that I picked up from a book in 1985-ish. And one of the things I did is I showed how the program itself that we're going to run can be encoded as a sequence of numbers written into the boxes themselves, and then the same memory that stores the results and the intermediate results and all that bits and pieces also stores the program. Mm. And that's cool. And we thought, like, oh, that's wonderful. The question I have for you is, how do we get the numbers into the boxes in the first place?
Right, okay. So, yeah, there's got to be a standard thing that happens when you turn the computer on that allows that to happen, right? Some kind of...
Absolutely.
...convention, right?
Absolutely. So that is true. But, like, if we're building our computer ourselves out of nothing, you know, we're assuming that some lovely silicon manufacturing company has made our little robot in his... In his box, and you know, we know what the robot does is that he starts at some place and he starts reading numbers and then he just interprets them as instructions and gets on with his life, and that's all he does. How do we contrive it so that those numbers are the ones that the robot wants? And this has kind of got a two-part answer, and we'll see how much time we have for this.
Okay.
The first part is, you know, how do we get the numbers in there in the first place, right? And if we're talking like actual real hardware, I'm going to sort of be doing this with a 6502 era-ish computer in mind.
Yeah.
And you might have seen, if you've seen, I mean, I'm sure you've done skits at the Computer History Museum, and they have lots of these old machines around. Some of them had physical switches on the front, and a way to put the numbers...
Yes, like the Altair, for instance, where you click, 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 click on the front. Yes, okay.
Exactly right. So the Altair had this situation where, yeah, you would literally dial in the numbers, and then you press a button to write into a particular memory location, and then you'd have to fiddle all the switches again, and then the next one. So it's a very boring and laborious process, right? And so that's a miserable thing to have to do. And there is also a way of manufacturing a chip that has the number sort of pre-baked into it. And so you can make a ROM chip, read-only memory, where all you're doing is building an integrated circuit who looks like RAM or like memory, but it's a big table of numbers. The problem with that is it's pretty expensive to do that. And certainly way back when, you didn't want to do that very often because it's painful. But for the purposes of the rest of this discussion, I'm going to assume that we have a very small program that we have already loaded into the computer through the switches or through like a one-time ROM chip. And what this small program is going to do is load a bigger program and then run that program. So the first, so we're going to assume we've got like a, you know, punch card. Again, I love how comprehensive this channel is because I can pretty much certainly say, I bet you've done something on punched cards before now.
Yes, we certainly have, yes.
It would be embarrassing actually now if you sat around and said, no, we hadn't, and then I had to kind of like put something together. But effectively, punch card is a way of putting values into a computer by literally punching holes in the right place on a sequence of cards. And the cool thing about this is it's kind of human readable for some definition of human readable. You can see that like there's a hole punched where the capital A is. So this is an A. And then on the next row, there's a hole punched at the B. So this is an A followed by a B and all that kind of stuff. Right. So that's sort of human readable and we can load it into the computer. But also the computer can punch them out itself. Right. You can hand it a stack of blank cards and it can punch out results and then you get the results back out. And now we've kind of got a loop where I could then take that and feed it back into the computer, for example. OK, so we're assuming that there's a tiny program in ROM or we've laboriously keyed it in that effectively says contact the punch card reader and keep reading numbers from the punch card reader until we get to the end of all the punch cards. And every time we read a number, put it into another one of these memory cells. And then when we get to the end, jump to and start executing these as instructions at the beginning. So we've kind of got a way of loading a bigger program in that we've written on punch cards. Okay. So far, so good. So there's a kind of like slow like iteration of a program in ROM that loads a program from punch card and... Maybe we'll see how that can go. But there's another question, which is that, like, if you remember way back when I wrote programs and I said to you, hey, it's really inconvenient to write down the numbers. So we're going to write out these things like, you know, LDA to mean load a number into the A register. And then I'm going to say like 37. That puts the number 37 into the A register. And then I'm going to compare it with, you know, 22. I mean, this is a pointless program. I don't know. I haven't thought through what I was going to do, but these are what the human reads, and it's this human readable. I'm going to put little bunny ears around it because it's like about as human readable as languages that are this low level can be. But that's not really what the computer sees. Again, what the computer sees is the sequence of numbers. Now, very specifically, what the computer needs to do is see numbers, and I'm going to get my little cheat sheet out here. So what I have over here is probably too small to see on camera, but it is a table that has all of the possible 6502 instructions and the two digits of the instruction. Now, these are hex digits. Most of the time, we've been doing everything in decimal because it made life a lot easier. But just think of it as it's a number. And so, you know, my LDA instruction here, which is load an A instruction, I'm going to search through my table. And I really wish I'd remembered where I'd put it, actually. Load zero page, load A. Oh, there it is. LDA hash. Again, that's probably too small to see. But I can see that that is number A... 9. So what I would have to put in the very first box for this program is the hex value A9. And then the next number is this 37, which I'm going to assume is hex for the purposes. So A937 are the two bytes that encode this instruction. Fantastic. Compare, you'd look it up and so on and so forth. And so some instructions are one byte long, one memory location long, some are two, some are three. And each instruction, each CPU has a different way of encoding this, right? So you could imagine writing this program, and after about the third or fourth instruction, you're ready to give up because it's so boring. You know, this looking up in a table and all that kind of nonsense. That's very, very boring. So we don't really want to do that. How much better would it be if I could write a computer program that takes this as text, like the literal ASCII values here of the LDA space 37, and then spit out the A937, then I wouldn't have to keep looking up in this silly chart all of the time. And, you know, it could do some housekeeping. It could make sure that, you know, I've written an instruction that actually makes sense. It can read the number afterwards, and it can add or subtract to do some things that may be useful. So that's great. So as a sort of point of explanation, this part over here, the human readable part, we call this assembly code. And this part over here is the machine code. It's what the machine itself sees. And they are one-to-one, right? Unlike other programming languages, which I know we've covered, there is a literal one-to-one mapping between everything I write down over here and everything I put here for the computer. And that makes it pretty straightforward to write a program to do this for us. And such a program is called an assembler. So now we have a kind of chicken and egg problem because I don't have an assembler and I don't even have a computer at the moment. So what do I do?
You've got to write that in the original way of doing it, right? You've got to go A937, blah, 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 all the way through till that creates you this program. But then I don't know what you would do with that program.
Well, exactly. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So, I mean, first of all, it is possible to write this kind of an assembler using just assembly code. The reason I know this is because I've written one and... proven to myself that it can be done in assembly code, right? Well, there's some properties of this. So the first thing I'm going to do, if I'm going to write this out, is that, yes, like you said, the very first time I write an assembler, I'm going to have to actually assemble it myself by hand. And so I'm incredibly incentivized to make it very short and very simple, because it's going to be huge otherwise. It's going to be pages. And so what I might do, so like traditional 6502 assembly, anyone who knows it knows that there are all these various different addressing modes and they're all conventionally written like with this either hash character or LDA and parentheses and a number, comma Y. That's all very complicated. So I'm going to simplify everything and make every single instruction exactly four letters long. So LDA here is actually going to be LDA hash, and I'm going to put the hash right next to the L, to show that hash here means it's an immediate number. I'm just comparing literally or reading the actual number 37. And the same with comp here. And then if I want to do this indirect load with Y, which is again a thing you can do with the Y register, adding it to some address, I'm just going to say LDAY because that's four characters long as well. And I'll do that for all of the instructions. And this makes things a lot simpler, My assembler effectively has to take the text that's come in and go through a table of possible instructions and compare four characters and see if all four characters match up with the table entry. Then the table contains the opcode, this A9, and then some kind of indication about what to do with any other numbers that are left afterwards. So, for example, we'll have a table somewhere which will literally be the ASCII values L, D, A, hash. Then it will be A9. Sorry, I'm going to put these little quotes around these to show that these are not the actual... This is not a number. This is the value of that. And again, I have my chart over here, which is incredibly dull, which is the ASCII table chart, which tells me that L, for example, capital L, is 3C. So this would actually be 3C in memory and so on, blah, blah, blah. A9... And then I would put one byte afterwards that say like 01. And that 01 is an indicator to the rest of the program that you should read another number and then just write one number in. So that would give us this A9 and it would read 37 and write 37 in. And then you would look for the next assembly code. So I don't want to go into that detail because it gets very complicated very quickly. But I just want to show that that's what's going to happen. We're going to write a program that loops over this table and look for the instruction and then writes out the bytes that correspond to the instruction that you wrote. So let's assume that we have written such a program. What are we going to do with this program now? We've got a program that we've laboriously hand assembled, and we've got like, I don't know, a couple of hundred instructions at a guess. And by at a guess, I mean, it's a couple of hundred, at least in the one that I wrote, that is simple enough to be able to do simple assembly code. Now, obviously, I would run my now famous Fibonacci sequence program, and I would show that that works. Hooray! And, you know, and obviously, sorry, when the assembler finishes, it will punch out the tape punch out cards that have the actual byte values of the assembled program in it, so that I can feed in the text of it, which is a lot easier to punch out as a human, and then I get back a stack of cards that are the actual program, and then I can run those cards back into the computer and run my Fibonacci program. But this is very simplistic, right? I would like to be able to write the actual 6502. I would like to be able to put labels and comments and other things to try and make my life a little bit less miserable as a programmer when I'm writing the text of this. So I want to improve this assembler once I've written it. So what's the natural thing to do?
You presumably write a better assembler using the assembler you've got, right?
Exactly right.
Am I jumping too far there?
Not at all. No, that's exactly the right answer. So the first thing you'd do is, having hand assembled this as a test, actually, is you'd feed the text that you'd written down on paper. You'd then punch out the text and feed it to itself. And the result should be a stack of cards that are identical to the ones you fed in the first place. And if they're not, you've got a problem. And then you can kind of fix and iterate on that, right? So at that point, you have an assembler written in machine code by a human that can now assemble itself into machine code. And now you've got this sort of virtuous circle that you were sort of saying, now I can improve it, right? I can now write a version that has a slightly more complicated string matching system that actually lets me put spaces in the right places, that lets me write labels and other things like that. And so you start to improve it. And then, of course, you have to feed the next version of the assembler. First of all, that the new assembler has to be written in the subset of assembly that you currently support, but it can itself support more instructions or more features. Once you've fed it through itself, you can then start adding new ones. And so you can kind of incrementally grow it over and over and over again. And I just think this is a bonkers part of computer history because, right, every program on every computer was built by a compiler or similar, which is a bit further down the line, but we'll get to that maybe in another video. But but that compiler relies on itself being compiled, which reminds, and so back and back and back and back, till eventually we get to an assembler somewhere on some computer somewhere. And maybe it was a different computer from the actual computer, as in different architecture. This is something called cross-compilation. But somewhere there is an unbroken line back to some poor sap who had to sit down and write in the machine code an assembly program to assemble itself. And I love that. It's kind of like DNA, you know, following DNA all the way back. There has to be some kind of unbroken line. And that is one of the more fascinating aspects because this sort of self ability to self-assemble, self-host, is also referred to as bootstrapping, incidentally. And for the same reason that your computer, when you turn it on, or in the computer we've just been talking about, where we wrote a ROM, a tiny ROM, that then loads a bigger program, that loads a bigger program, that loads a bigger program, that now has a disk driver and can find the hard disk, and now the hard disk can run up, and now it can load the USB drivers, and now it can load everything else, right? That kind of thing. That is... the analogy there is pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, which is obviously self-evidently impossible, right? You can't lift yourself by pulling your own bootstraps, but that's what the analogy is, and that's where booting comes from. And so we're also, in the same way that a computer boots up by kind of starting small and growing, even the process of writing computer languages starts out small and works out big. And so you could imagine that once you've got your assembler up to this beautiful self-hosting thing that supports comments and error messages, which obviously my first version does not, it just breaks and stops if you've got anything wrong, you might be tempted to say, well, it might be better to not have to write in assembly at all. I would like to write in a simpler language, a high-level language like C, which will make everybody laugh because C is like very much understood to be a low-level language. But compared to machine code, it's a couple of rungs up the ladder. And so the first C compiler, in C you write things like for int I equals 0, I is less than 10, plus I, and a program runs and turns that into, well, let's put I in the A register or the X register, and then let's put a label here, and then we'll set it to 0, and then we'll increment it, and when it gets to 10 we'll stop doing this, right? And all the things that you'd have to do by hand yourself is laid out for you by the C compiler. And obviously, without invoking too many flame walls in there, there's a lot more to C than just things like that, but you know, the idea holds. It's a higher level language, but it still maps very closely to this assembly code. So obviously you can write your first C compiler, but you have to write it in assembly, which you can then feed to the machine code version, right? And then once you've reached a point where your C compiler feels stable, you're going to rewrite it. And you're going to rewrite it in what language, do you think? Because assembly is really inconvenient.
It's going to be C, right? It's got to be.
It's going to be C, yes. This is the inception moment, right? Again, whereas with assembly, we kept writing assembly in assembly until we got to a point. Now we've reached a point where we've written an assembly program that compiles C programs, and it's good enough for us to then feed a completely new program that is also a C compiler, but written in C into it. Now your mind explodes at this point. And at that point, C becomes a self-hosting language, provided, again, we never lose a working C compiler. We can always compile our new version of the C compiler in C to make new C compilers, right? And so on and so forth, right? And so it's almost, and you know, just to sort of bring this into the fore, most modern programming languages, you know, you've heard of like Rust or C++ or whatever, they have this sort of moment where they go from some initial implementation language, be it C or assembly or Haskell or whatever, some other language, they get to the point where the compiler is sophisticated enough to be able to write that language's compiler in that its own language, which is kind of a proof of concept, right? If you've designed a programming language, it ought to be powerful enough to write itself in. And there's a sort of like switch where you kind of have to swap everything over and you kind of wave goodbye that original implementation and you never go back to it. You've kind of jettisoned it off. It was part of the, you know, pupation into a self-hosting language. But then, you know, there are so many, you know, I see people posting on the internet, you know, what language is C written in? And you go, C. And you're like, well, how? How can you write it in itself? It doesn't make sense. And now you know.
Yeah, you make your way up to it. Is there a term for that when you hit that point? It's almost like the coming of age of the language, almost.
I believe they call it self-hosting. It's where the language itself is able to host its own tool set in its own language.
Is there a danger of people losing touch with what, why and how, and you know, do you sort of mean this kind of like if somebody isn't keeping abreast of where it all came from, or does that not matter anymore? Are we beyond that?
I mean, obviously enough people know about it and care about it, and I think that's one of the beauties of this sequence of conversations that we've been having, is that most of the time you don't need to know about most of the things that I'm talking about. Like, there are people who love it and care about it, and that will always be an unbroken line back, I think, to this. And I mean, I went through a period of time where I thought to myself, gosh, because of the age I am and the computers I was exposed to, I know all this stuff, right? And the books that we've talked about, how on earth can, you know, the students that are coming into my company know all this stuff? But it turns out people are interested in this, or a certain set of people is, and they will come and find it anyway. They will go out of their way to find these details. And somebody needs to know this stuff, but not everybody. But it's fun.
Like that, not horizontally. The most amazing thing you then discover, which threw me for a while because I'd rather forgotten it works like this, is that if you now put the card down on a black background, and we'll use another card as